welcome to the Gadget Show podcast and a very happy new year to you from me, Susie Perry.
Amazing. Happy new year. And from me, Jason Bradbury.
Yeah, in the first episode of 2025, we're getting a sneak peek at the gadgets to watch out for this year. We're also chatting with Dan Harvey, who is Samsung's UK head of consumer electronics, and he'll give us the lowdown on their headline tech to expect over the next 12 months or so. Plus, for our gadget of interest, we have a very posh watch, the Amiga Speedmaster Pilot.
And that's not all. We're giving a nod to our partner, JBL's Tour Pro 3 earbuds. With stunning spatial head tracking, these earbuds make you feel like you're right in the middle of the action, whether that's a concert, a movie, some music, or the recording of a very cool Gadget Show podcast. It's got audio tech that's all about keeping you in the moment, no matter where you are. If you want the best audio for 2025, maybe these are for you.
Yeah, so I'm wearing them right now, and combined with this natty little case, they're perfect wherever you are, in the gym, whether you're watching TV, a movie or whatever, or whether you're travelling.
Okay, so we love them, but also so does Mr. John Bentley, who's recorded a deep dive video on them, which you can check out on our YouTube channel. So if you want a pair, there's a link in the details of this very episode.
Right then, shall we get on with this episode?
Yep, let's get into it, Suze. Right, shall we start with some comments from our lovely gadget gang, Susie?
Absolutely, great idea. So after a lovely break for Christmas, we came back to some amazing comments from our festive special. Remember that with John and Otis?
I loved it.
Oh, and congratulations must go to Mo B from Cornwall, who is now enjoying their Tour Pro 3 earbuds after winning them in our Epic Peck Sounds quiz. And actually, when I saw Mo B from Cornwall, I thought, yeah, is that Jason? Is he done like
I know, yeah.
Alternative name there?
Yeah, he's based himself on the DJ and he just to get a free pair of headphones. No, it really wasn't me, but I'm proud that someone from my local county, it's not my home county, but I live here, has won them. Well done, Moby. Anyway, that quiz was cool, wasn't it, Susie? I think we should probably do another one this year.
Yeah, I agree with you, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so got a comment from, I don't know if I'm going to be able to say this properly, Rio's Christ Do Lao. And there's some numbers. Anyway, to be honest, says Rio, my Prezi was seeing you guys back doing the best tech show on the planet. Well, thank you very much. I think that's, I'd love to think that we were. Maybe as we progress, we'll get to that level. But thank you so much. It's lovely of you to be so positive.
Yeah, thanks. And Chris Forrester on YouTube, he says, I totally love the Fab Four. The Gadget Show Live was a must-buy ticket when they were being run. So thank you guys for being awesome and having such a positive impact on my young adult life. Wherever the Gadget Show brand goes, I will be sure to follow where you are. Most welcome and thank you very much.
We better not be rubbish then, Suze. And then I've got one from Analder9911. It's great to see the legendary crew back. I've met Susie and Jason at... He says the roadshow means Gadget Show, I'm guessing Gadget Show Live, many moons ago. I have a question for Jason. I remember Mercenaries TV, which showed how to hack old school. Gaming has advanced so much. Can you see similar shows in the future? So just to be clear on that, Mercenaries was a show that I created. It was my first ever commission in terms of creating a TV show and producing it. I produced it as well as hosted it for Bravo, which was... I don't think Bravo's around anymore, but it was a cable TV channel aimed at kind of gadget show audience, actually. And the idea of the show was I used lots of available games on different platforms and PC and console, but I kind of wove a narrative around them. And the idea was that you had two teams that were against each other with a number of different challenges. And the team that won each week would open a kind of cell door and there'd be a big bag of money in it. So there were mercenaries and they'd do things like we'd use Microsoft Flight Simulator to try and land an aeroplane on a tricky, you know, landing strip or maybe it would have been Counter-Strike to do some kind of, you know, multiplayer game. But it was kind of woven into almost like a military narrative. Does that make sense? And so do I feel that something narrative like that in this, you know, in the vein of things like Nightmare and those shows in the 90s, I'm guessing Nightmare was 90s, I do actually. I think some narrative woven stuff is quite good. And actually, when you think about it, Mr. Beast does that, doesn't he? He has this interesting narrative. Can we do this by the end of the episode? And they win money, don't they, often? So, yeah, I think there is room for that sort of format in the future, but I'm not going to be the one to do it.
It probably won't be on terrestrial TV, sadly, though. But
I think you're right.
Yeah, we've sort of moved beyond that, haven't we? Just reminded me, when you talk about landing a plane trickily, I think I'd finished doing the Gadget Show, but I got to go in a typhoon. And the day before, I went on the sim and had to land the typhoon. And honestly, all the Gadget Show experience came into its own that day. It really did. And
did you nail that landing?
Next day, I flew and we broke the sound barrier and we did a loop and it was just incredible. It really was phenomenal. One of the best days of my life. Anyway, I digress. Steve H from TikTok, also on the subject of TV shows that you did, Jace. Little late night show called Store at the End of the World, God, he remembers.
Yeah, so that was, I can't even remember what cable channel it was. Just to put your minds back, there was an explosion of cable channels. If you remember, Susie, there was a kind of something happened with the legislation around TV channels, and companies like Granada, LWT, ITV, BBC, they just realized that they could kind of double, treble, quadruple their output by starting different cable channels. It might have been something like BBC Learning or something. I can't remember what it was, what the channel was. But the show was a gadget review show. And do you know where it sent me? It sent me to CES. And I I went to CES. This is probably 5, maybe even earlier, maybe 7 years before the Gadget Show. It would have been around the 2000s. I went to CES, all paid for, which to me was amazing. And I guess I kind of learnt my trade. I didn't know the Gadget Show was around the corner, but yeah, it led to that. I just want to say one thing, actually, because Bennis Happy has also sent a comment from TikTok, and we wanted to say hello to TikTok, didn't we, Susie? Because we'd kind of been ignoring the TikTok platform, and we kind of exploded on it a few weeks ago.
Well, yes, hello TikTok, and you're very welcome to the Gadget Show podcast. Stay with us and subscribe or whatever you do on TikTok.
You're right, we need your subscriptions as well, because we're going to try and grow that platform. But Bennis Happy said, the competitions on the Gadget Show when I was younger would blow my mind. You're not the only one. When they listed all that stuff, I would plan where I would put it or sell it.
I think everybody did that, didn't they? And yes, they did really deliver a lorry full of gadgets to the winners. Tall Man with Glasses on Patreon, he says, my Christmas tech memory has to be the year I received Commodore 64, which led to a lifelong passion for all things 8-bit. One final thing to mention to Otis, you'll be pleased to know I've still got that 3D printed rocket you made me when you lost the Gadget Show Toy Challenge. Well, we'll pass that on to Otis. Thank you so much for all your comments and keep them coming. We love to hear them.
And a big shout out to our Patreon members. If you'd like to get involved with our Patreon subscription, you get all kinds of really, really cool exclusive content. So have a look in the details of this podcast. Right, Susie, 2025 is shaping up to be a big year for tech. I mean, it really is, isn't it? We say this every year, but this year is going to be amazing. So, shall we run through what we're excited to see this year?
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you kick things off?
My first headline gadget that I'm beyond excited to talk about, Susie, is the Switch 2.
So what do you want to see from that then?
Well, I guess from a personal point of view, I'd like to see something innovative around it, yeah? Traditionally, Nintendo, as you know, are responsible for some of the most unique interfaces that we've ever come across. The Wii being possibly the best example. Mm. But also in the portable space, you know, 3D, flip-out double screens, some really interesting software that interacts physically with the device in a way that most other gaming portables don't even attempt to do. A novel interface and some novel software to back it up. Maybe an 8-inch OLED screen with a higher resolution and much better colour. I've always felt it's a little bit desaturated, the current Switch. Custom silicon, maybe a faster processor from NVIDIA, and maybe some AI, maybe some deep learning super sampling, or the sort of automatically generated landscapes. So kind of some interesting open worlds that, you know, something like a Switch would be great to experience, you know, based on the fact that you can take it anywhere in your back pocket, use it on the bus, use it on the train. RAM storage, bigger options there. I don't know, but I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, what about backwards compatibility? you know, support for existing Nintendo Switch titles, making it easier for players to transition to the new system, but without losing access to their game libraries. I think that would be good.
That would be good. And maybe because we've got better connectivity and cloud-based gaming services like, you know, Game Pass that we seem to mention a lot on this show, we could see better AAA title experiences on that platform, you know, rendered in the cloud, as it were. But also, you know, locally on the device, Legend of Zelda, Super Mario, you know, new launch titles from those epic franchises. That's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, and then I guess, you know, staying true to its kind of hybrid nature, the Switch 2 will or maybe should aim to improve portability, but without compromising on the performance with everything that you've said above there.
I agree. And I think that's possible because we've had huge strides, haven't we? I don't want to keep referencing the Vision Pro, but the Vision Pro is a good example in this regard because, you know, it's a thin device that you wear on your face. It's comfortable and light enough to wear on your face, and yet it operates like a relatively high-end computer, right? And that's because there's been so many advances in terms of GPU and CPU performance. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that the Switch 2 could be, you know, from a hardware point of view, quite a beast. Very exciting.
And it sounds like it's likely to debut early March this year.
Wow.
With a price point $350 to $400, they're saying. So
right,
slightly
okay, so
above the original Switch, but maybe that's, you know, taking into account the new features.
Yeah, $350 actually it'll be for us, won't it, with the old VAT and that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, their focus on Switch 2 is about bridging the gap between casual gaming and high performance, really. That's where they need to go. Because that's certainly what, if Xbox do deliver a portable, that's what that's the arena they'll be stepping into. Although Nintendo traditionally doesn't compete, I guess, in that same sense. They're more about the novelty factor. You know, the way that you interact with their games is often really funny and unusual. You know,
yeah,
lots of accelerometers and you know what I mean. Like it's
slightly lighter as an experience,
yeah, very
in a
much
way.
So.
That's not
yeah.
too. You know, diminish it because they've got to remain competitive, and there is obviously
very much so.
Their market is huge. So it'll yeah. be really interesting to get our hands on one of those, won't it? But for me, it's all about the foldables. I feel
okay.
like this year. So Google, Samsung, Huawei, Oppo, and more are in the game. But these sleek devices, they only make up 1.5% actually of the smartphone market. But
wow.
maybe that could change this year, Jace. I mean, I definitely think it could. We might see their share rise slowly to perhaps around 3%, which would be to double it. Folding tech might be on the verge of having a moment. In terms of what we know, what is coming, the Samsung yeah. Galaxy Z Fold 7, that is expected to be released mid-2025. And it promises several advancements to maintain its status as leader in the foldable technology market. So here are the kind of things that you could anticipate. So larger displays, the Fold 7 might include an 8-inch main display and a 6.5-inch cover screen, offering, well, you know, presumably much more of an immersive experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These upgrades build on the design principles of the Fold 6 Special Edition, which emphasised the much thinner, sleeker profile. And enhanced durability as well. There are indications that Samsung will improve the durability of the folding mechanism and materials, which
yeah.
it will address that long-standing concern about wear and tear in foldables, which I know you've mentioned before, Jace.
Yeah, it's an issue. Like, it's always been an issue. But to be fair to them, they have really risen to the issue. And recent iterations of their foldable phones have much less of the creasing and some of the other issues, you know, associated with folding an active display. I mean, I've always been a bit cold to this market.
I know you have.
But I'm going to be honest now, you're really changing my mind. Your enthusiasm for it has me thinking a little bit, because if I ignore, right, my experience of what was actually a couple of years old foldable Samsung phones, that's kind of where my experience is. I haven't got with the new tech. I've just seen people talking about how they've resolved the problems. If I ignore that, and if you say to me, what if you grabbed your iPhone, Jace, and you were able to fold it out a couple of times and have it three times the display. Would you like that? I'd be like, yeah. I mean, I don't know how you're going to do it. I don't know how it's going to not be a big, thick, you know, doorstopper sandwich in my back pocket. But if you can make it a similar form factor to that, maybe a bit thicker, same weight, but I can get three times the screen estate, hell yeah, I'd definitely sign up to that.
Yeah, I mean, I like the fact that they fit in your pocket, because my phone at the moment currently doesn't really fit in my pocket, to be completely honest. And if it's slim enough and it doesn't have, you know, a mark on the fold out, and the camera's good. So that's what I would also like to see this year. Haven't really found any specifics on this, but Samsung, I think, are likely to enhance the camera setup and processing power to compete, you know, with flagship standards in 2025 this year. Mm-hmm. And the rumours suggest the possibility of a dual folding Galaxy model, which would be in addition to Samsung's foldable lineup, emphasising the innovation in screen, well, real estate, really. And I think Samsung continues refining its foldable technology to set benchmarks in this segment. And the Fold 7 is poised to, you know, push those boundaries a little bit further. As I said, it's a small segment of the market, just 1.5% at the moment. But I do think it's worth talking about, because I do think it's, you know, it could grow its spotlight this year.
I love it. No, honestly, genuinely, watch this space. You've got me excited for this one. Okay, so I've got another one for you. And listeners, regular viewers and listeners might not be surprised to hear me saying AI again. But I want to talk a little more specifically about AI agents and their kind of physical form, AI wearables and assistants, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I would just say one of the reasons why this sector keeps coming up on this podcast is because there are few sectors in the technology landscape that are innovating as quickly as AI. It is mind-blowing. I don't know if any of you were listening to or are aware of the 12 days of OpenAI. So 12 days of consecutive announcements from AI, one of the leading AI developers on planet Earth, just before Christmas. One of the key announcements there was the open access to something called GPT-01, which is a much deeper thinking model than GPT-4 Omni, and also interesting Sora, which we ought to cover in a future episode actually, because Sora is a text to video creation model. So you could literally say, I want to see a podcast studio with two people talking at microphones, and it would just generate the video for you. So it's absolutely nuts, but that's for another episode. Right now I want to talk about AI agents. If you're unfamiliar with that, AI agents are best described as intelligent systems that can analyze environments and interactions to perform specific tasks on your behalf, right? So it's a bit like, what's his name? I never remember this, the AI assistant that Iron Man has in his helmet.
Jarvis.
Yeah, that's it, Jarvis. Yeah, so it's like having a Jarvis, right? But generally specific to different areas, right? So not a coverall Jarvis, but maybe a Jarvis that's there for food creation, you know, like recipe help. Think about them as highly focused, specialized assistants, right, who can handle a variety of actions in the background. These AI assistants are now going to be centered at the heart of our interaction with our devices via things like Alexa, Siri, you know, Google Assistant. So Alexa, for example, might get its own Claude. Siri could undergo yet another brain transplant, and Google Gemini might completely absorb Google Assistant, turning it into a conversational platform. That's what I'm expecting. Yeah. I can't predict it with any great clarity. What do you think about this, Susie? I don't know about you, but I've always felt that my interaction with my Google Home device now just feels antiquated, because I'm more used to using GPT and you know, the intelligent response that you get from that.
Yeah, I suppose it might depend on the uptake in essence. You know, the big question is how many consumer apps will integrate pre-built AI agents. And more importantly, for me, I know I always seem to be the boring voice of reason here, but,
no, it's
you know, how will it be adopted? How will consumers be using them? How will consumers feel comfortable using AI? And what elements, you know, will be adopted? And AI agents, I suppose, will be all over business applications, transforming how industries can operate and how we interact with technology. But it's got to be adopted first by the consumer, hasn't it?
Yeah, and that's why I say, you know, Alexa, Siri, Google's equivalent, that's why I feel those interfaces are where we're going to see those agents, because that's where the rubber meets the road for most consumers. But anyway, sector to watch in 2025.
Yeah, absolutely. And another sector to watch, I think, in 2025 is rollable TVs slash projectors. Oh, I'm going to throw in as well here.
Yeah.
So rollable TVs, they're expected to evolve this year, with companies like LG, they're leading the charge, really. And their flagship model, the LG Signature OLED R, that already offers a rollable display that can unfurl from its base to reveal a 65-inch OLED screen. This model isn't just about innovative design, though, but it also offers fantastic picture quality with 4K HDR OLED tech.
I just want it. Sorry, I'm salivating. Carry on.
So the TV also has the ability to partially unfurl into a smaller screen size for use as a smart display. That's another key feature, which I think is fantastic. I know you do as well. While this product has had a premium price tag costing upwards of $60,000. That's obviously a lot of money. It's a glimpse, really, into the future of how TVs could integrate into living spaces without dominating them when they're not in use, if they can, you know, roll back effectively.
So this is why I think this is exciting, Suze, because if my family is anything to go by, there is something of a pushback, isn't there, against screens. We're all kind of aware that we've almost been led by the nose into having our eyes fixated on screens all the time with this sort of dopamine, you know, cycle. And actually, we're trying to now get the kids, especially, off the devices. We're trying to do more, you know, family activities. And actually, the idea of a television that you can just get rid of, and, you know, if you do some yoga or do some board games in the front room, not dominated by a screen that's there all the time. I know you can turn it off, but when you actually get rid of it, out of sight, out of mind, you know, I quite like that idea.
I wonder whether it also makes it more special, you know, if you're sort of almost rolling out your cinema effectively.
Yeah,
like, oh, yeah. Exactly. Get the old ba 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 music.
Yeah. Oh, God, don't.
So I think, you know, other brands are likely to kind of join in this, but the market at the moment obviously it remains very niche. But you can expect to see advancements not only in the technology itself, but also in its integration. I think this is important with smart home ecosystems. So they would offer seamless, you know, less intrusive experience, which is what you're talking about here. Companies may also experiment with more affordable variants, though the cost remains a barrier for mainstream adoption in the immediate future. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. I mean, look, considering that this has been the domain of private yachts until now, like it is.
Which we've all got one of them down the garden, haven't we?
Yeah, of course. And we're not suggesting that £60,000 or whatever it was isn't utterly ridiculous, right? But one of the advantages of having done this show and been tech reviewers for, you know, almost three decades, in fact, for three decades, is that we can see that this could be affordable, and that this technology, if it's adopted, could well be £1,500 in 3 years' time. So fascinating, really interesting.
For the design-conscious consumer, TV systems like Bang & Olufsen's BioVision Harmony, they're also pushing boundaries with adjustable screens that fold away to make the TV less obtrusive when it's not in use, offering a sort of elegant solution, if you like, for big spaces. In summary, this year, you know, we're likely to see rollable TVs grow in prominence, although I think they will, you know, as you say, they will remain luxury or premium product for most consumers. But as technology advances, it always, you know, becomes cheaper. So yeah, hopefully your vision of a cheaper £1,500 solution may occur within the next few years.
I tell you what I would like, an Apple Vision Pro 2. What do we think about that for 2025? Or maybe a Meta Quest 4. So I think in 2025 that most desirable of mixed reality XR displays, they don't like to use the word VR, do they, the Vision Pro at a staggering $3,500 could well be condensed into something a bit more consumer friendly. So a kind of Vision SE model around about, I'm going to say £1,500. I mean, it's more likely to be something just south of $2,000 maybe. Difficult to predict, but I reckon it's got to be. I think what they'll do is they'll bring the Vision Pro down in price to $299, and then they'll release a $1,499 you know, consumer-friendly version. That is me being very specific, Susie, so you can come back to this. My head is on the chopping block. The new model, the cheaper model, might reduce hardware features such as fewer cameras and definitely the absence of that much promised front-facing camera display that just kind of doesn't work, you know, like with the eyeballs on it and stuff. It just, it's kind of, it's beautiful, but it's really expensive. Get rid of that. A focus on native apps for the Vision OS, I think, is anticipated. There's not a lot of apps available for it, being honest. I don't own one, but I've heard this as a criticism. I think maybe they need to open up more to possibly game developers and other developers from other platforms and make them available with a Vision Pro kind of spin, yeah? In fact, I have heard a very substantiated rumor that Apple have been working with Sony on doing a Vision Pro version of the Sony, the PlayStation VR 2 hand controllers, Susie. Because the lack of physical hand controllers with the Vision Pro is one of the reasons why they can't seriously get into gaming. Like, you can use your Bluetooth, you know, you can use your Xbox controller with it. You can use most controllers with it. But VR is about, you know, it's about holding a device in each hand, isn't it? And moving around really easily, walking into space, shooting, things like that. So that could also be something to look out for in 2025. You heard it here first. So yeah, and sort of enhanced gaming across the Vision Pro platform. And we can't mention VR, Suze, without good old Meta. Maybe a Quest 4 announced.
There's this battle for the market now. So yeah. Why not? I mean, it could happen. It's been talked about.
Well, it's the everyman's platform, isn't it, Quest? I sit here with, you know, I literally have two. I have a Quest here, look, Quest 3, and I've got a Quest 2, right, literally here. And I wasn't even in anticipation. I'm holding them up for those listening. A Quest 3 and a Quest 2. That wasn't even in anticipation of recording this. I'm so into it. I've got them. And I've got others. I love them. And one of the reasons that I've got two is because I've got kids and I like to interact with them. And we have some VR game experiences and ping pong and, you know, other things. But they're really inexpensive. You know, they're inexpensive. Yeah. And that's the thing. So a Quest 4 is going to be the premium, the new premium one. And then the price of the Quest 3, the already affordable Quest 3 will go down. And the Quest 3S, is it? I'm getting confused now. Will probably get even cheaper. So I think the slow evolution of VR and mixed reality that will eventually lead to us getting rid of our mobile phones, flip, foldable or otherwise, is continuing. It's just a bit slower than maybe I'd anticipated.
Right, those are our thoughts for this year, 2025, and what maybe to expect. I mean, we could, you know, get it completely wrong. Who knows? I've got a bit niche, but hey, we think we've covered some decent bases there. Let us know what you think we're going to be seeing this year. Today we're joined by an incredibly special guest who is at the forefront of consumer electronics and the innovations. As Samsung's UK head of consumer electronics, Dan Harvey oversees the cutting-edge developments that shape how we experience technology at home and beyond.
Hi Dan, how are you doing? Thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to the show. I guess we want to dive into, what's next for Samsung in 2025, get some insider insights into how the company is, you know, leading the charge into everything from obviously your foldable tech, which I know is hugely important to your next few years, and your AI powered home gadgets. So yeah, what have you got for us?
Hi Jason, and hi Susie, thanks for the incredible introduction. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity for joining you. Thanks for having me. Look, I mean, massively exciting time, Jason, as you alluded to, in terms of technology and innovation that is coming to market at the moment. I've been with the company for 10 years now, across a host of different roles, having had the opportunity to work in home appliance division as well as consumer electronics and TV. And I suppose one of the challenges for, you know, journalists and podcasts like yourself is keeping pace with the exponential change in technology. Even in that time, you know, you talked about mobile phone. You know, when I joined, we hadn't long forgotten about buttons on phones, right? And we're already into the third generation of foldable phones. When I think about home appliances, from what was quite a utilitarian category, you know, Samsung's been a massive disruptor in that space, where we've taken that from what used to be sort of distress purchase. You'd change your washing machine or your fridge freezer once the other one was on its last legs. Now we've got like real genuine demand from consumers for the latest innovation, the latest connected experience, the latest voice activation of devices in home appliances. And then in the area I'm working in now, and have been more recently in consumer electronics and TV, massive step change in not just screen technology across QLED and Neo QLED and OLED and 8K, but now we're really starting to see the emergence of AI and the kind of benign, supportive, iterative learning that artificial intelligence can bring to those categories. So that's definitely the kind of new frontier, new era of innovation that will shape the home appliance, the mobile, and the TV category going forward. And it's something that consumers are already showing a massive willingness and an engagement with. Right? I heard yesterday just in the UK on the back of the Galaxy AI launches this year, there's now 4.4 million UK consumers using Galaxy AI functionality on their phones on a frequent basis. A massive step change, huge engagement in it, and kind of adding value to those new experiences with AI.
I think I just wanted to get your view on one thing, and that is, it occurred to me the other day that I wonder how the dominance of apps is going to fare when one AI, you know, one voice, AI-powered voice assistant can effectively do the job of most of your applications. I wonder whether the concept of apps needs to be re-examined and whether that's going to be something that ends up being consigned to history. How do you feel about that in terms of the way that people interact with your products, be it your television or some of your other home appliances, and how they all, you know, they all kind of, they're all extensions of a central AI?
Great point. And I think, you know, we'll see, there is, you know, let's be honest, a proliferation of applications, right? And one thing that we know about consumers is they want simplicity. They want things to be easy. They want things to be intuitive as possible. Certainly when I think about the connected experiences we're bringing to market across all of those devices and across all of that portfolio, you know, we've got a massive advantage as a company. I mean, I'm sitting in our connected suite in London now, our SmartThings London. You know, we've got a bedroom and a bathroom and an office and a kitchen. All of those devices across tablet, PC, wearables, mobile, washing machines, fridge freezers, robot vacuum cleaners, TV, soundbars, air conditioning, you name it. So we're touching every single part of the home and every single part of people's daily lives. But there's two things we know about that connected experience, to your point, is consumers want something that is simple and intuitive to use. And that's where something like SmartThings really comes into its own. So it doesn't matter whether you are an Android or an iOS user. It doesn't matter. You know, you can access hundreds of partner brands, Philips Hue Lighting, Hive Thermostats, Yale Security, Ring Doorbell, you know, hundreds of partner brands and products that become interoperable. But most importantly, you can access and control through one single application, which is SmartThings. So I think if we do a combination of those things, Jason, which is bring all of the incredible technology that sits in the hardware and package it around an application and a service proposition that's singular, that's where you get the sweet spot, and that's where I think you really make a difference to people in people's everyday lives, right?
You've probably half answered the question that I wanted to ask you, Dan. And it's really about, you know, Samsung products are always there as a premium product, but how as a company do you manage to stay ahead of the competitions? What are the factors in that you have to be very aware of?
Yeah, you're right, we do, and we're proud of that kind of premium position. I think one part of that is just an extraordinary level of investment and capability when it comes to R&D. To engineer the kind of technology and innovation that consumers can enjoy. If I think about TV and audiovisual as a category that I'm currently responsible for, these are considered purchases that consumers want to make. They're spending hundreds and sometimes many thousands of pounds on a premium product, and they want to do that from a brand that they can trust, first of all. We're in the fortunate position of being the fifth most valuable brand on the planet, according to Interbrand. So there is that heritage. We're proud of being a globally trusted brand. And outside of the technology and innovation that's baked into the product, there's probably a few things around that premium proposition that consumers may not instinctively be aware of. And there's a couple that are important now in terms of emerging trends. One is absolutely with regards to security. Connected devices, more internet-enabled devices, there is an increasing awareness from consumers that that comes with certain risks. The way we use our TVs now for browsing and for e-commerce, all kind of account and password-related. So we've got something called Samsung Knox, which is a security platform we use across all our devices, in mobile as well as home appliances and TV, to give people the reassurance that within that premium product and premium product experience, they have real peace of mind when it comes to security. There's a ton of free content on our devices now. Samsung TV Plus, for example, non-subscription, thousands of TV channels. Samsung Gaming Hub is another great example. Again, free streaming of, I think, about 3,000 games, including things like Fortnite, Call of Duty, Grand Theft Auto, which probably mean more to some of your listeners than they do to me, to be honest, as a non-avid gamer. There's lots of stuff around that premium proposition on top of the technology and on top of the innovation that's baked into the product that I think is part of that kind of discerning consumer purchase for a premium Samsung product.
Dan, regarding the future of TV and AV, what trends do you see emerging in the world of home entertainment? Is there anything specific, you know, that Samsung are particularly exploring at the moment that you could share with us?
Yeah, we touched a little bit on AI already, and I think that again will be, you know, a continued emerging trend for the appreciation for AI features. We're doing a huge amount of work and research on our processing capability. We introduced already this year some groundbreaking technology around AI processors. You'll see a huge amount of AI upscaling capability bring to market over the next 1 to 2 years. That's been a challenge for the industry in terms of streamed content, low frame ratio or HD and UHD content. Now with processing capabilities to upscale to 4K and over 90% of 8K quality, you'll see that coming through more and more TVs, bringing that technology into more accessible price points as we go into 2025 and 26. I think more broadly, voice will be, you know, the key gateway to interacting with product across a whole, across our entire ecosystem and portfolio. And then you have things like micro LED, which we've been exploring for a number of years. Extraordinary screen technologies. It's some way off being a real consumer proposition, but we're trying to work really hard on accelerating that. You'll see that as we showcase some of that product again at CES in a few weeks' time. That will be undoubtedly the future of screen technology on top of what we can already enjoy today in terms of OLED and Neo and 8K.
One of the dimensions of a kind of AI-infused entertainment experience, you know, is that things like foreign language content, what's going to happen with that? Can AI provide us access to, some Japanese manga, but with really good English translation? Or what are you doing in that space?
Yeah, great question. And you know, we're again in a very fortunate position where we have a mobile division that's leading the way with its Galaxy AI capabilities. We're obviously taking a lot of learnings from that and a lot of technology experience from that in TVAV. So as we look forward to next year, one of our pillars of our AI strategy is around personalization and accessibility, right? On top of just picture quality and sound, we want to make AI functionality as accessible to as many people as possible. We're working with the RNIB and the RNID, and have been for a number of years, the Royal National Institute for Blind and Deaf People, to bring a whole suite of new features, specifically targeting those that are visually or hearing impaired, right? That's part of that accessibility strategy. So if I play that out in features and functions, you know, we're going to be in a position where we'll have live multi-language translation of live content, first of all, and it opens up some brilliant Amazing. Opportunities for AI iterative learning when it comes to on-screen sign language as well. So these are areas we're already exploring. I can't give too much away at the moment, but they are they're going to be coming to market in the near future.
What I was getting at is the problem with apps is that app developers want their slice of your digital pie, right? And so what actually ends up happening is that you have multiple accounts and signups for all kinds of different platforms on one mobile device. And even the act of me buying I recently bought a PlayStation 5, a PS5 Pro, and the amount of signups and kind of convoluted, annoying stuff I had to go through in order to input various, you know, account details to get various applications working on it was very frustrating. And it seems to me that an AI assistant loaded with, you know, a secure assistant with all of my details could just make that process so much easier. Is that kind of where you're going?
Directionally, absolutely. Yeah, the integration of apps and the usage of them, the consolidation of that experience, Jason, to your point, is what's most important and what will be appreciated most by consumers. The details of which, you know, I'm not close enough to share with you today, but certainly from our experience of using a platform like SmartThings, we've always had a strategy for open innovation in terms of partnerships, to widen that ecosystem as much as possible, to be as inclusive as possible for other brands and other products, but do so in a way that allows that consumer to access, control, monitor everything through one single source app, in this case, which is SmartThings. So that's always been the Samsung approach, and directionally that will be the way we'll continue to try and drive that app usage and app consolidation. Yeah.
With AI, the kind of secret source that binds it all together. Dan, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. I'm very intrigued to see that you're actually in a Samsung location. Before you go, just tell me, I've spent some time at Samsung KH, I think it's called, in King's Cross, hence the name, which is a great space, an experiential space. And one of the things I loved about it was that you have a kind of community theatre where you invite people from the local community to come in. I was actually going to book it and do it with my wife, who's an institutional therapist, and do a cooking event. Interesting, because you've got a kitchen and it's almost like kind of informal theatre, isn't it? Where are you now, and where's that going in terms of how Samsung approaches retail and the high street?
Yeah, great. And look, I'm at the moment, I'm in the SmartThings London connected suite, which is at our head office just outside London. So I've got a kitchen, I've got a bedroom, a couple of bedrooms, a living room. I've got an outdoor garage area with a carport and a connected car.
No way.
So this is where
You had the pretend car, sorry to jump in KX, didn't you, with the kind of dashboard of the future, which now feels like you can go and buy it now, but then it was a demo when I saw it.
Yeah, the simulator in KX was fantastic. So we've got these two facilities, one here which we use mainly for partner engagement. It would be a great opportunity for you to come and do a podcast and film one from this suite if you're up for that. But yeah, I think for the consumer opportunity, the experience centre we have at Samsung KX, which is at Coldrops Yard in London, not far from King's Cross Station, is a space in which we can showcase all of our products, and there's some great use cases there in terms of that connected experience. But as you said, there's some great community projects. We do a lot of our community and social responsibility work from King's Cross, from KX. So it's a brilliant space for consumers to go and explore. And there are two things around this whole connected environment. One is, we know consumers don't miraculously wake up one day and have a house full of connected stuff, right? They build that connected portfolio one or two products at a time. And we want to enable them to do that. So, simple stuff. I honestly never lose that small sense of joy when I'm sitting in my lounge watching my frame TV, immersed in a program of whatever sort, and my little pop-up tells me that the oven has finished and I better get in there and turn it off before I ruin what's in there, right? Just tiny little things like that that bring stuff to life for people to experience those connected capabilities. But yeah, get down to KX. It's an amazing space, and we're always happy to host people here as well if you want to come and do a podcast, Susie, and hopefully the internet connection will be better here than it is in the south of France.
Dan, Jason and I would love to come down and have a face-to-face chat with you. That would be absolutely fantastic. But thank you for joining us on the podcast today. It's been really fascinating listening to you.
Okay, time now for our gadget of interest. And we've got a very posh watch, haven't we, Susie?
Yeah, this week, the highly revered Omega Speedmaster.
Oh my gosh. Love this. So excited. I used to own a Seamaster, an Omega Seamaster. It was a vintage one from the 80s. It was really, really beautiful. Uh-huh. But I was a bit skint one month and I had to sell it, which I really, really regret. Anyway, there are a few luxury watches as revered as the Omegas, and the Speedmaster is one such model, often dubbed the moon watch, because obviously it earned its legendary status during the Apollo 11 mission. That being the first time that humans walked on the lunar surface. What a gig that was for Omega. Whoever did that, Susie, needs a bonus.
I think the PR behind that was fantastic. Whether you believe they actually wore them or not, it doesn't matter because it's stuck and it's a great tag.
Amazing. As opposed to a tag her.
Yeah.
But for those who think the moon's a smidge too far, the new Omega Speedmaster Pilot might be just the ticket, although you're going to need some pennies. We'll get onto that bit in a minute. This one's designed with pilots in mind and has a couple of tasteful aviation-inspired nods on the sub-dials. At the 3 o'clock position, for example, you'll spot a twin-hand sub-dial. So it shows both 60-minute and 12-hour chronograph readings. Hopefully I'm making this into visual pictures for you that makes some sense. With an orange triangular hand, which of course is styled after the burn rate indicators you'd find in a cockpit. Then over at the 9 o'clock position, there's the small second sub-dial. So this one's got the target straight lines and blue horizon of the kind of horizon indicator, that you get on the dashboard of an aeroplane.
Yep.
Anyway, all of that stuff sits in a robust steel case. If you're interested, it's 40 mil across and about 14 mil thick. It's got a just under 50 millimeter lug to lug width, which makes it very wearable, not too heavy, but heavy enough to know that you've got something worth a small fortune on your wrist.
Well, it's quite a chunky appearance, but I reckon it'd be all right on my wrist, actually.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Get your nudge in there. Go on.
Yeah. Well, if anybody's listening. So as you'd expect from Omega, the movement inside is absolutely phenomenal. It's the Coaxial Master Chronometer Calibre 9900, certified to the highest standards for accuracy and magnetic resistance. Plus, it offers a 60-hour power reserve, so you're covered even if you forget to wind it up for a couple of days.
Do you wind it up, or is it just perpetual? Is it kinetically wound? Anyway, I don't know. It doesn't matter. You've got two strap options. That's what matters. It's got to look good. The classic steel bracelet that you'll be familiar with if you know Omegas, or you can go for the grey NATO strap, which is reinforced with Kevlar threads. I do love this. I do love a kind of military watch, Suze. You know, like some of your RAF mates, they get given these watches, don't they? In fact,
yeah.
I think they get Omegas, I'm sure they do. When I used to live in Lincolnshire, near the RAF bases, I'd often see pilots in the cafes and they'd have those with the NATO-style strap on it.
Yeah.
That set against the brushed steel buckle and the fascia is just a beautiful combo.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous.
How much is it?
Well, I was going to say, it's not cheap. You're talking about, you know, the best part of £9,000, really. £8,900 in the UK. That's pricier than the standard Moonwatch Professional, but in line with the other two Counter Speedmaster models.
I'm breath slightly taken away at that price, although I know enough about watches to know that it's, and this is allegedly, probably an investment. These watches tend to hold value. I don't know about buying a precious watch of that sort of price brand new. I'm sure, like a posh car, it's probably got a fall off. But over time, the investment of that, which may to some of our listeners and viewers sound a bit obscene, is often quite a reliable investment. I don't know. But if you love it and you've got that kind of money and you appreciate the exquisite engineering that goes into that, then I think it's maybe something you should consider. But there's a more affordable way of getting an Omega on your wrist, isn't there, Suze?
Yeah, I was going to say, just on that note of affordability, because Omega teamed up with Swatch, actually, and these are highly collectible as well. The Swatch X Omega Moon Swatch range. They kind of go out at about £350, around that sort of price.
£350.
You know, are really popular. I think it's a growing market, Jace, as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's, I think that particular range, I mean, look, it's a Swatch and we love Swatches, don't we, Suze? Yeah. I wish I still had my white kind of, you know, it was a kind of, I don't know how you'd explain it. It had lots of 80s colours and shapes on the face, really bright yellow and blue and red, but it was a white strap and white fascia. And I loved that watch. It meant an awful lot to me. It was a beautiful piece of sort of 80s design. And those watches now, the plastic Swatches from the 80s, are worth a fortune secondhand.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that Omega joined with Swatch. It says several things to me about brand awareness and about affordability as well, but it also combines to give you a really great collectible watch that will, you know, increase on a lower level, obviously, but I still think it enables a whole new audience of people to collect watches and have that excitement of, you know, swapping and buying and selling watches, which is what half of it's all about, really, isn't it?
It is, and it's a lot more affordable than £8,000. Maybe more on watches in future episodes, Suze. I'm quite a fan, so maybe let's come back to this.
Yep, that sounds like a great idea to me. But that is all we've got time for in this episode.
Yeah, it's been absolutely brilliant. Keep your comments coming in. If you are, you know, enjoying our content on YouTube or Spotify or even TikTok, then also please subscribe, because that goes a long way to getting the various platforms to recognise that people are interested in the content that we're making. And if you're diving into more episodes of the Gadget Show podcast, please make sure you're doing it on JBL Tour Pro 3s with their crystal clear sound, adaptive noise cancelling and amazing battery life. They are, of course, in our opinion, designed for people who demand the best audio experience. Plus, that case with the little screen on it is a game changer.
We love the case.
We love the case.
Yeah. So until next time, stay curious, stay techie. And next time, we'll have a CES special for you.
Oh, I can't
join
wait.
Us for that one. See you next week.
See you next week.
The Gadget Show podcast with Jason and Suze was presented by Jason Bradbury and Suze Perry off the telly. It was produced by Ewan Keel and Tom Clint and is a North One production.